I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, colleges and universities are facing a growing number of high-stakes challenges, including threats of mass shootings. But also, there is the issue of anti-transgender politics interfering with the teaching of actual science. Anti-DEI dictates from the right, questions about free speech in the classroom, and campus protests related to geopolitical conflicts. And then there's the rising cost and the burden of student debt, as there are rising questions about the need for college degrees into the future, and we have the rise of AI. All of this happening on college campuses. How can universities meet these challenges, and what is lost if they fail? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
TPR stands apart in today's crowded media landscape. We bring calm to a noisy world and offer space for thoughtful dialogue. Now, as we enter the new year without federal funding for public media, we are stretching to keep this essential service available to everyone. Your year-end gift helps us continue providing the trusted journalism you rely on. Visit tpr.org to make your gift today.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Higher education is going through a rough patch. Public confidence is down. Tuition debt is a real thing, but the job market is ugly. College campuses have become flashpoints in America's political culture wars. But Beverly Daniel Tatum says this is exactly why colleges matter and why the country can't afford to lose sight of what higher education is for. Dr. Tatum is a psychologist, a longtime college leader, president emerita of Spelman College. She's the author of the book Peril and Promise, College Leadership in Turbulent Times. And Dr. Tatum, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much, David. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, I want to talk about the latest terrible thing that's happened on a college campus, which was a shooting that happened at Brown University on Saturday. Two people were left dead, at least eight others in critical condition. The search continues for the suspected gunman. This is not a, you know, it happens. We're seeing college campuses targeted with some frequency for mass shootings. And as a college president, as a leader, how do you deal with something like this? Because college campuses are open environments typically.
You're exactly right. They are open environments. And I have to say that what happened at Brown is a college president's worst nightmare. Certainly our hearts go out to the parents of the children who were killed and the whole campus community clearly traumatized by this event. One of the things that I have learned over the course of my years as a college leader is that even if it doesn't happen on your campus, it frightens everyone because you know it could. And there, you know, you can have locks on the doors and cameras and, you know, do what you can. And this is a generation of young people that have grown up with active shooter drills. And several of the young people who were on site when the shooting took place credited those drills with their ability to survive the attack. But still, it's just heartbreaking for the campus community and all of us to know that this is part of American life.
There was also a shooting at Kentucky State University earlier, and that's a historic Black university.
Yes.
We're seeing HBCUs targeted, and you have some insight.
Yes, well, we know that campus violence is a problem everywhere, but HBCUs have in particular been targeted for bomb threats and other kinds of related violence, certainly some shootings, but even when there haven't been shootings, there have been over the last several years, which I write about in my book, a rash of bomb threats that have involved FBI investigations and some arrests of what turned out to be minors. You know, people, a young person in particular was not identified because of their age, but it is really, I think, a reflection of the deterioration of our society in terms of the polarization of our language and all of this. We don't know, of course, anything about who the shooter was at Brown or what the motives might have been, but the assault on institutions, not just higher ed, but churches that are affiliated with the African-American community, I think is a reflection of growing intolerance in our society.
Yeah, so you have to look, each individual shooting is its individual shooting. You have to look at them case by case. But looking broadly at this, it seems symptomatic of a general distrust that some parts of society have for higher education.
It is certainly the case that there is growing distrust in American institutions of all kinds, and that certainly includes higher education. Over the last several years, polls that have looked at, you know, American attitudes toward higher education have shown a rise in skepticism about whether college is worth it, about whether the investment makes sense, whether it's better to just go to trade school. I mean, these are the conversations that are taking place. And we do live in a time when clearly society is in transition. You know, you think about what it means to have artificial intelligence developing as rapidly as it is, what the implication of that is for entry-level jobs. For example, the job that maybe a college graduate would have gotten, you know, 10 years ago, maybe is now being done by artificial intelligence. So what does that require? What kind of education is needed to be successful? I do want to say that when we talk about higher education, though, we often talk about it as a individual good, a private good, something that benefits the individual who pursues it. And we don't often talk enough about, I think, the benefit to the wider society. What does it mean to have an educated population able to ask critical questions and to problem solve about difficult issues that are facing our society? What does it mean to have learning environments where students from different backgrounds, domestically as well as international students, can get to know one another and develop the kind of soft diplomacy that leads to more peaceful outcomes internationally and domestically? And what does it mean to have a community of problem solvers, smart people who are learning to think critically about the social issues that are not just social, broadly speaking, I mean, the, you know, whether it's the environment or scientific discovery or how to generate a positive economy in the artificial intelligence age. All of these are questions that smart people can think about and talk about and hopefully bring that intelligence to bear to the benefit of the larger society. So I think it's important for all of us to think about it, not just in terms of my kid and what it will benefit my kid, but what does it benefit all of our society to have a well-educated populace?
Well, saw a story, an article in the Chronicle Higher Education encouraging the use of AI in order to do some of the drudgery stuff of administration in universities and so that more time can be used in actual time with students and creating an environment for excellence and success.
Absolutely. There is opportunity, I think. You know, in my book, Peril and Promise, there's a chapter that looks specifically at how artificial intelligence is being used on college campuses, and it's, you know, rapidly developing. You know, something you write today is probably going to be not quite current, you know, next month, because it's rapidly developing. But, for example, the professor who is teaching physics can develop videos and artificial intelligence tutoring using AI that help confused students get clarity. If I'm a student confused about the lecture and I want to ask, I'm trying to do my problem set in the middle of the night, I can't call the professor in the middle of the night, but I can get feedback from the AI tutor that the professor has trained to be helpful 24 hours a day. And then that allows me to come to class with better clarity, better able to ask questions, and take full advantage of what the professor can offer.
We're taking a break.
That's
here.
That's just one example.
Yeah, we're taking a break. We're going to hear more about these challenges on college campuses, how campuses need to change, evolve, recognize what's happening, and the need for them in the future. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. The Source continues right after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Higher education, it's not just a ticket, a pathway to a better job, but it's also a public good, essential for the health of our democracy, to international understanding, and to solving the toughest problems that our society faces. But the leaders of college campuses, they're facing so many challenges, and they have to draw on a pool of courage, practical leadership, coming together, helping people identify their own individuality as students in order to create a new future. We're creating a future right now, and college campuses have to be part of that, but they're facing so many challenges. We're speaking with Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum about that, and she is the Emerita President of Spelman College. So, Dr. Tatum, what do you see as the biggest challenge for college campuses?
I think as a president, as someone who sat in that seat, one of the biggest challenges is, of course, financial. How do you provide a high quality education at a price point that students can afford and still pay your faculty, your staff, the salaries they need to be able to meet their living expenses, and do that at a time when prices are rising, cost of healthcare for your employees are rising, you know, the pressures are growing, and yet the public capacity to support college education is declining. We know, for example, that the population growth in the United States has declined. The number of college-age students is smaller today than it was in previous generations. You know, we are not having as many babies, and that means that there are institutions that are struggling to fill their seats just from an enrollment point of view. A president sitting in that seat is really trying to figure out how to keep the doors open, because colleges rely on the tuition dollars that students pay to support themselves. Even those that are funded by the state have seen their state budgets cut. And private institutions typically don't receive state support, so they are particularly dependent on what students can actually pay. And that's a real challenge.
We're seeing right now in real time the deconstruction of the Department of Education under the Trump administration. The Department of Education has been very helpful in helping students find financial aid and helping higher education. What do you see happening there? And is that a challenge?
It's absolutely a challenge. You know, you asked what's the most challenging thing, and I mentioned finances, and that's probably perennial all the time. But in this particular moment, the apparently adversarial relationship that has developed between the federal government and a number of college institutions, and more broadly, I think higher ed as an institution, with the changes in, for example, how scientific grants are awarded and the growing restrictions on what can and cannot be taught with the various executive orders that President Trump put forward, all of this is new. I think there has been a long-standing partnership between higher education and the federal government that goes back decades, at least as far back as World War II. And yet, in this moment, in this current moment, we find that partnership really being dismantled in ways that are quite disturbing. I think many college presidents worry about it in terms of the impact on academic freedom, what the freedom of speech, not only for students, but for faculty to teach what they know without intrusion by the federal government, or the state government for that matter. These things are, you know, there have always been times, I think, when people have found controversy. You know, campuses are places where people come to think broadly, young people are exploring questions. There have always been sites of controversy, but I think this particular moment in 2025, almost 2026, is particularly challenging because there are so many unknowns. It's become so unpredictable.
Well, this question is going to sound overstated, but I think it needs to be out there. Are we living through a time where the party in power has embraced anti-intellectualism? They say they're anti-elite by looking at universities and colleges and that education system. But we've seen authoritarian systems before, and they always, it is a part of an authoritarian regime is to go after universities and campuses. And it's happening out there in the open right now in real time with the destruction of the Department of Education and these open attacks on college campuses and what they stand for. But we're not really able to say it out loud that this, you know, this administration is anti-university. You know, but does that need to be said, or am I overstating it? How do I put that in actual context?
I do think that what we see is incompatible with the idea of America's greatness. What I mean by that is that higher education has been what some people refer to as the crown jewel in America's reputation. For decades and decades, people have wanted to come to the United States to pursue education in whether it's the flagship state institutions like UT Austin or the private ones that we all hear about like Harvard and Columbia and Princeton. You know, there are thousands of institutions across the nation, and all of them, almost all of them, have international students who have come there because they have heard about the greatness of higher education. And it seems to in the United States. And it seems to me that we now are in a moment when what has been a symbol of greatness is really being attacked in a way that undermines its effectiveness and diminishes the reputation of the United States. So I find it hard to understand how this benefits the United States in the long run.
Well, when you have an authoritarian who wants his narrative to define reality, yet you have an independent body that uses data and research and studies and rigor in order to define reality, those two things are in conflict.
Absolutely. You are quite right about that. And that said, you can't solve problems with fantasy, right? You need to solve problems with facts. And if we want to create a better society, continually improve, we need to rely on accurate information. We need to be able to make accurate predictions, whether that's about weather or whether that's about
economics,
disease or economics, or about, you know, how best to teach children how to read. All of this is important, and all of it is currently being undermined. And, you know, does it benefit a leader to have less educated populace? Perhaps. I have heard, and I cite in my book, speeches where J.D. Vance, for example, has praised Viktor Orban in Hungary for the way he has managed higher education, and which has been to take control, to limit what can be taught, to eliminate, for example, gender studies, and to really restrict academic freedom in Hungary. And when I think about that, if we see that as a model, as it has been articulated perhaps by Vice President Vance and to my understanding also President Trump, if we use Hungary as a model, then we have to ask ourselves, you know, what are the famous Hungarian universities that we might lift up as an example of a high quality education?
I want to talk more about that. We're going to hit this break here. We're going to do some pledge drive stuff. And then we're going to come back and continue our conversation. Peril and Promise, College Leadership in Turbulent Times. Beverly Danielle Tatum is with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
What's good? It's Gene Demby from Code Switch. NPR has been hearing a lot from listeners who are pitching in to keep public radio strong after federal funding for public media was eliminated. So we wanted to share some of what folks are saying in their own words.
The following clips are dramatic readings of real public radio donor comments.
You folks cover important local news.
Tiny Desk brought my brother and I together.
The interview I heard today by Michelle Martin was excellent journalism.
Supporters also say that they like that NPR stays above the fray.
You provide the important information without all the drama.
But what we're hearing most, just how important NPR's independent news coverage is in this moment.
Thoughtful, objective news is critical to sustaining our democracy.
It's where I look to find the truth about what is happening in our country.
Add your voice to the growing community of public radio supporters by giving to this station today. And thank you.
I'm David Martin Davies, and you're listening to Texas Public Radio's special two-day winter fundraising drive. We're going to get back to the source content shortly, but first I want to talk to you about making a meaningful gift before the year ends. As the year comes to a close, many listeners have chosen to support Texas Public Radio with an end-of-the-year donation because they value trusted news, local reporting, and programming that connects our community together every day. A gift now helps sustains this work, and it's also it's going to give you a little pop benefit at the when you do your taxes for 2025. If Texas Public Radio has been a part of your year, please consider making an end-of-year gift right now. Give us a call, 800-622-8977. You can go on the TPR app or go to tpr.org and do it. Your support makes a difference right now, and with me here to tell you more is Dan Katz.
And we appreciate the sustaining support from Quinn Alexander's four-legged friend up in Austin. And we're grateful to Maria Ibanez in San Antonio for her sustaining contributions as well as another monthly donor who listens at KTXI Kerrville. Every gift being matched dollar for dollar right now to support The Source. And on the program today, Dave, we're talking about the growing controversies around higher education, academic freedom, standards, funding, and who universities are really serving right now. And I keep thinking about a Latin teacher I had in high school, an immigrant from Italy, who once told me, watch out for the higher education standards in America. If they're lowered, it would not be good for this country. And we're in a strange moment right now. It could go a lot of ways. And our job here at Texas Public Radio is to help make sense of it with context, with nuance, with real conversation. And during our short holiday fundraising drive, your support makes that possible. So you can give now, tpr.org. You can call 800-622-8977 to support our local talk show, The Source.
We're looking back at 2025, some of the top stories of the year. We've got a new mayor this year in San Antonio. Gene Ortiz Jones will be the mayor for 4 years. We've had ICE raids across San Antonio, across the country, with these new policies about anti-immigrants from the Trump administration. Project Marvel has been a story we've covered a lot this year. The Kerr County floods, the Bidle Creek flood, All sorts of things happening across San Antonio over the last 12 months. Texas Public Radio has been there covering it. Robert Robertson death penalty story. We've been covering that. I've been covering that. I've only been able to cover that because of the support from listeners just like you. Vouchers, transgender rights, the drought, what's happening with hemp and THC. There's no limit. And there's so many more stories that I wish we could get to. We just need more support. We need more help in order to really cover it, because as Texas Public Radio strives to grow and do more work telling people stories about these events that are happening, other news outlets are having to pull back or being taken over by billionaires. This is your public radio station. This is your community station. If you want to figure out a way to counter the corporate takeover of media and news, this is your solution. This is your opportunity. We can't do it without you. Listening is great, and I'm so glad you do listen and you tell your friends about how important public radio is. But if you don't support us, you're not helping us. We need your help. We need your support. Give us a call right now, 800-622-8977. That's how you do it. Or you can go online to tpr.org. You can use the TPR app. Your support is essential. It's necessary. We cannot do it without you. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Higher education is in crisis. American colleges and universities are facing declining enrollment and rising cost. Campuses have become ground zero for the culture war, sparking debates about diversity, equity, and inclusion and access, about free speech, so many other topics. What is happening on the college campus? How do we support college leadership in these turbulent times? The book is Peril and Promise. We're joined by Beverly Daniel Tatum, PhD, to talk about her experience and her insight as she is an experienced college president. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What's been your experience on college campus? What concerns do you have? So, Dr. Tatum, you know, let's talk about this attack on DEI.
Yes.
It seemed like we had set up a system where conservatives love to talk about meritocracy, and that, oh, if you work hard, if you strive hard, you play by the rules, you'll do well, and you have a place in society, and you have a place in leadership in our society. And we set up the system in college campuses, and we told kids in schools, regardless of, you know, where you, what demographic you were, even kids who were low income and from hard scrabble parts of the country, work hard, study hard, do well, get into college, take on that college debt and climb up the college ladder, and you can come out on the other side with opportunity and opportunities to shape a better America. And that was happening. But now it seems like they're changing the rules deliberately, because the wrong people were taking advantage of this system. We were seeing a lot of people of color, a lot of women succeeding in college campuses. And now they're saying, well, college degrees don't matter anymore. Well, what we need is something different. And it's more about where you're from and who your parents were than it was about how well you did in school. I mean, that's my view. Am I wrong?
Well, you're certainly not wrong that the attack on DEI is, in my view, correlated with the success of DEI. You know, as
right, they wouldn't attack it if it wasn't working.
Exactly. You know, I want to quote Dr. Martin Luther King in his last book, which was titled, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? And one of the things he said in that book, which was published in 1968, now, you know, a long time ago, but still quite relevant to this moment. One of the things he said was that after every period of social progress, there's pushback against that progress. And we are feeling a lot of pushback against the gains that were made by women and people of color during the last 50 years, right? You know, since the 70s forward. And the pushback is strong because the progress was great. So here we have a situation where we feel that progress. But I do think it's important to acknowledge that there are ways that when people feel left out, they raise their hands and say, hey, what about me? And I think in the case of the ways that DEI has sometimes been talked about, white men in particular have raised their hands to say, what about me? Am I part of diversity? Am I included? And of course, the answer should be yes. And I think in many places is yes. But when we talk about DEI, for example, we seem to talk about it as though it is only about women and people of color. But when we talk about diversity, we know that everyone contributes to diversity and that diverse teams are more successful than those teams that are not diverse. That problem solving is done better when you have multiple perspectives than when you have some of, you know, a lot of homogeneity. So one of the things that we have to think about is how can we talk about the purpose of DEI in a way that is inclusive and doesn't feel exclusive. That doesn't mean to say that there won't still be pushback against social progress. That pattern repeats over and over again in history. But we also know that everyone wants to be seen, heard, and understood. So if we are thinking about higher education as a place where all kinds of people have something to contribute, then we want to think about how do we create an environment where we are affirming the identities of all of our students, building a community where everyone feels supported and can be successful, and cultivating the leadership of the next generation so that people know how to engage across lines of difference. If you are graduating from college and haven't learned how to be around people different from yourself, you are likely to be what I'm going to call a dinosaur. Because in this world, not just in the US, but globally, you're talking about multicultural communities that require flexibility and the ability to connect across lines of difference. That's a fundamental skill that you can get in college if institutions are intentional about fostering it, but it's essential. And my advice to parents is that if you're sending your kid to college, you want to make sure that they're developing those skills.
But we need people in leadership who, especially if they're going to be trying to figure out how to serve the United States and people across the United States, who
yes.
come from all different sorts of backgrounds. We need doctors. We need black doctors available to serve the black population. We need researchers and surgeons and all these people from the diversity because they understand the cultural differences, and it's important for people to see themselves in others that look like them who are in positions of authority. In order to have the America that we're supposed to be having when we say the Pledge of Allegiance.
There's no doubt that we need that all of what you just said, that it is necessary for the society to be effective to develop leadership across communities. That, as you said, certainly young black men and women want to aspire to, whether that's law or medicine or engineering or whatever it might be, it benefits them to be able to see people who look like them who have achieved those things. It benefits white students as well, actually, to be able to understand and recognize that talent comes in all sizes and shapes and colors. And so as we think about creating learning environments, one of the things I talk about in my book is what I call the ABCs: affirming identity, building community, cultivating leadership, because that is what's needed. It is quite discouraging to see what's happening at the national level, to see, for example, women and men of color being removed from positions of responsibility for reasons that seem unrelated to their performance. And that whitening of leadership across the federal government seems to be intentional, from my view, and it seems to be misguided. But at the higher ed level, what we do know is that talent comes from all communities, and we want to develop that talent for the leadership that the United States is going to need in the future.
So we're seeing politics trying to shape what's happening on college campuses and in college classrooms. So we've had an instructor at the University of Oklahoma. He was recently placed on leave after a student complained that she received a failing grade on a paper where she cited the Bible to assert the belief that the belief in multiple genders was demonic. And this is something that's also happening in Texas, where we're having state leadership, Governor Greg Abbott saying, no, there's only two genders, and any school like Texas A&M and Texas Tech University that teaches anything different is in violation, and they want consequences if they do that. But the science tells us, no, it's not just two genders. There are all sorts of gender traits that are shared, and we have plenty of examples that tell us that. So we're having this conflict of what they want the world to be and what the world actually is, and it's and the collision and the explosion is happening in the classroom.
It absolutely is. It's a really challenging time for instructors, for faculty, for the administrators that support that faculty. It is, you know, I'm a psychologist, as you mentioned in the opening of the program, and for many years, I taught a course on the psychology of racism. I wrote about much of what I learned teaching that class in a book that your readers might be familiar, your listeners might be familiar with, called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race? And I am sometimes asked, you know, Dr. Tatum, would you be able to teach that course today? And the short answer is, there's some places where I probably couldn't. And that is, I think, tragic.
But it's probably the places where it needs it the most.
Well, not only that, but students who took my class, many of whom were white students, most of whom, you know, I served as president of Spelman College, which is a historically black college, but my teaching career prior to becoming a president was entirely at predominantly white institutions. And most of my students taking that psychology of racism class were white, and they regularly told me at the end of the semester how much they felt they'd learned and how beneficial it was to them. And, you know, I've been an academic, I've had an academic career spanning close to 50 years. And the reality is I hear from former students still who will write to me or send me a note to say, that was one of my favorite classes, I learned so much in it. And I think it's just tragic to think that there would be places where I would not be allowed to provide that kind of rich learning experience for students.
We're taking another 1 minute break. We're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum. The book is Peril and Promise, College Leadership in Turbulent Times, Why We Will Need Colleges and Universities into the Future, Even in the Age of AI, and questions about the merit of a college degree. These are important questions. Why do we have college campuses? How do they come about? And why are you going to need them in the future? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Peril and Promise, College Leadership in Turbulent Times. We're speaking with Beverly Daniel Tatum, PhD. We're going to have fewer college campuses. That's just a matter of fact, right? There's going to be a contraction in the number of campuses. What impact is that going to have?
We already see that contraction taking place, in part because, as I was mentioning earlier, the declining number of college students, just in terms of the demographics. You know, there was, during the pandemic, a drop-off in babies being born, and those babies, whether in the pandemic years or even before, are going to not, you know, if they weren't born, as someone said, if they're not born, they're not going to college, right? The number of seats available, college seats available, will exceed the demand. The supply is going to exceed the demand. And so some small colleges, particularly those in rural parts of the country where the population has declined, are likely to be on the edge of closing, and some of them will close for sure. We have already seen that increase in closures over the last several years. What that means for a community is a tremendous loss. If you think about what colleges mean in a town, It may be a major employer. It is a place where children get to learn how to swim at the local college pool, where community members can come and hear speakers and see art performances. And, you know, really thriving communities are often made even more healthy by the presence of a college community, by a college in their community. When it closes, it's tragic for everyone. And yet we do know that there will be a consolidation just because the population of college students is declining. That said, we also know that there are adults who want to get, who may not be the traditional college age, but who want to get a more advanced education because it benefits them personally and professionally. And that's an opportunity, I think, that colleges and universities have to strengthen their presence in the community by expanding their focus, not just on the traditional 18 to 22-year-olds, but also those 30-somethings or those women and men who have are maybe in their middle years, their kids are grown, and now they want to finish that degree that maybe they started years ago and didn't have a chance to conclude.
They say that colleges no longer have that monopoly. I mean, I can go online and I can take online courses and learn about philosophy and art and things like that.
Sure, you can. You can do that online. And there is much to be said about the convenience of online learning for those who really might not be able to spend 4 years in a residential campus. I think we have to understand that the delivery of education can take a number of forms. You know, I, in my own academic career, spent my teaching time and my leadership time on residential campuses, small four-year residential campuses. And I think those offer wonderful learning opportunities for the students who can take advantage of it. But it's not the only way to experience higher education. I do want to say that on average, though, when we talk about is it worth it, you know, debt is a problem for many students, but it's particularly a problem if you don't complete your degree. I often say debt and no degree is a personal disaster. We want to be sure that if somebody starts, they are able to finish because it's the completion of the degree that will deliver the goods, whether that's better employment opportunities or a lifetime of earning that comes as a result of completing that bachelor's degree or even going on for a master's degree or a higher level of education. But it's the completion that matters.
In this book, who do you want to read this book? Who needs to read this book?
Well, when I was writing my book, I was thinking about not only future college presidents. Of course, if you
it's
are
a small market.
Yes, it's a small market. That's exactly right. When I decided to write the book, I was inspired in part by the questions ordinary people would ask me. They'd say, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a college president." And then they'd say, "Oh, that's a really tough job." And then they would ask me something about why does college cost so much, or where should my kid go, or how do I think about what I see on the news when students are protesting on college campuses? There's a lot about how colleges operate that the average person just doesn't understand. I like to think of this as an insider's guide to higher education.
Yeah, not just so right now we're dealing with college campuses really being ground zero of so much happening in our politics, our culture war, so much around us all the time. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of understanding about what really goes on a college campus and why things are happening the way they're happening.
And that was exactly why I wrote the book. I wanted to make clear to people what is going on and why, and how can good leadership make a difference? You know, let's just talk about the college protests that were taking place.
Well, we're running out of time. But we had the Gaza anti-protesting, how turbulent and explosive that became. Yeah.
Some campuses did a better job than others, and a lot of that has to do with the leadership that was being provided.
But we need to make a really good case why college campuses need to exist in the future. There is a place for college campus in the future.
There's no doubt.
Danielle Tatum, thank you so much for coming on, telling us about your book, Peril and Promise, College Leadership in Turbulent Times. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
Dan Katz here, Vice President of News at TPR. If you need a second opinion on whether public radio is worth supporting, we went to a guy who knows a thing or two about lasting cultural impact. You might have seen him recently at the Alamo Dome. Sir Paul McCartney said it best on Morning Edition just a few weeks ago.
NPR is great and must always survive and educate us all in the ways of life.
When a Beatle tells you to support public radio, you kind of have to listen. You can call 800-622-8977, or you can give online at tpr.org. Let's come together and help keep public radio going. Long and winding road and all, thanks for your support. We get by with a little help from our friends.
And I want to hold your hand as you dial this magic number, 800-622-8977, the magical mystery tour of keeping Texas Public Radio going down that long and winding road. We need your support. We can't do it without you. The number is 800-622-8977. Use the TPR app. Go online to tpr.org. I'm David Martin Davies, and with me in the studio is Dan Katz.
And we are thankful for a new sustaining member in Pipe Creek who says, "You are our lifeline to sanity in these divisive times." Thank you. What an endorsement. Also want to give a shout out to Curtis Stolte in San Antonio for your donation to TPR. We have $75,000 left to raise to meet our goal. Every pledge counts. You know, Dave, it's all hands on deck here at TPR. Just yesterday, I was helping produce The Source during a show about loneliness and how to combat it. And the callers truly made the conversation. And this is what happens here every day. Day in and day out, real people, thoughtful listening, civil dialogue, whatever the noise there is on social media, this is a place for meaningful conversation, civil dialogue being alive and well. Now is the moment to make sure it's not going anywhere.
You know, so many big stories throughout the year of 2025, the Rainbow Crosswalk, what's happening there. Looks like the city of San Antonio is going to have to pave over the Rainbow Crosswalk. Why is that happening? Why is that being targeted? How does that make us safer or better city? The Guajalote Ranch, the questions about the water supply with that development, Jonathan Joss's, his murder, everything that's involved with that, the King of the Hill actor. The messed up streets around downtown San Antonio. Why is that construction taking on so long? So many stories, you know, and you want Texas Public Radio on the beat to get these stories. Without us out there asking the questions and putting public officials on the record, we're not going to get the answers that you deserve. But also by putting them on the air here on The Source, you get to ask the questions yourself. How many times we've had Mayor Jones on the air? It's a format. You get to ask the questions and call in. We've had Judge Peter Sakai on. You know, we're bringing the newsmakers, the leaders of San Antonio, Bexar County into the studio. And this is something that you asked for. We've heard this from our listeners. You know, you want this, and we made it happen. We're responding to your requests and your needs, and we're going to continue to do so. We've got a lot of plans for 2026, but, you know, we'll be able to, you know, have the wheels to get there. Well, that's up to you. Call Texas Public Radio, become a sustainer, become a supporter. We can't do it without you. 800-622-8977. Use the TPR app or give online at tpr.org.
We want to say thanks to a new sustaining member in Bernie for their support of the wonderful programming here on TPR. And we just got an update from Pledge Central, $71,571 left to raise. We set out to raise $100,000 for this holiday drive going into 2026, $71,571 left to raise. As we wrap up The Source today, I just want to say thank you for your generosity and for showing up. Thank you for listening, for calling in, for engaging with these conversations with care and curiosity. The kind of community is what makes The Source possible. During our short holiday fundraising drive, your support truly helps keep The Source going strong. If you're able to, please give online at tpr.org, or you can call 800-622-8977. Thank you so much for being a part of the conversation.
Texas Public Radio is community-supported public radio. That means the community, we answer to you, and we take the lead from you. Well, what questions do you have about what's happening in San Antonio and across the state of Texas? It's all up to you. We follow your lead, and now's your opportunity. We're asking you to lead by calling 800-622-8977.